This is an interview with Mr. Bernard Mednicki, 10962 Templeton Road, Philadelphia, 19154, 632-4636, on April 27, 1982, with Josie Fisher. Mr. Mednicki, could you tell me a little bit about your family and their origins?
My father was born in Kishinev, then Bessarabia. My mother was born in Odessa, that's Ukraine. While in the service in the Russo-Japanese War in 1902-3, I guess, my father heard of the oncoming pogrom from Kishinev. He was in Vladivostok. He was already married and he had two daughters, Rosa and Sheva.
How old was he when he had gone into the service?
He was born in 1884, I think he was born 1884, mm-hmm. 84. Yeah, that makes him about 16 or 18 years. See, I always count in French, 35 years in America. Well, that's something to think of. But it's characteristic, I think, of the adult newcomers to the fresh country. So, he married very young. And
he had married before he went into the service?
Yes, of course. Mm-hmm. He married, he has two children.
Mm-hmm. And then he went in?
Yes, he went in. Not that he wanted to.
No.
You know, when the Tsar said that the Jews lived there, my father was already the new breed. That means he was already the Jew, the fighter. He was already no more the Talmudist. He was already the left wing of Judaism. That means he believed, but he learned the craft. And he was a fine, all-around mechanic in blacksmithing, foundry, engraving. He was a fantastic mechanic.
So he also had his Talmudic training?
Of course, he had his Jewish training, yes, like every Jewish child from old days on. Mm-hmm. Now, my grandfather, one of them had a... One was a shoyret, and my father's father, he was a cap maker, a little cap maker. Cap maker, yes. Mm-hmm. Those were the Jewish professions of the time. After the pogrom, my father did his share to defend his family. My father was very powerful. I mean, physically, like I am, I'm very physical. If not, I wouldn't survive the war. And after fighting, he took my mother and the two children.
He had been discharged
from
the army?
No, there's a deserter.
He was a deserter.
Of course,
okay.
Most of the Jews at that time deserted. Who could live? When they had a chance, they deserted.
Was not that a dangerous thing to do?
It was very dangerous. It took him 1 year to escape from Russia to come to Belgium. He stopped in Austria, and for a while where they were happy, but it was too close to Russia.
He went back to Kishinev and got your...
He fought in Kishinev. He left Vladivostok, came to Kishinev, fought the program, took my mother and the two sisters, and ran away. He ran away, and he wound up in Belgium after 1 year of all kind of adventures. Mm-hmm. He had in mind, like every Jew, to come to America. But my mother gave birth to a child, and they remained in Brussels. Why not in Antwerp? Because that's where he was stopped. He found a job immediately because he was an excellent craftsman. The language was not a barrier because the 10 fingers speak when you know what you do.
About what year was that?
1906. Mm-hmm. He came to Belgium.
Mm-hmm.
Six or seven. Six, I would say, yes.
And at that point, your mother had had two daughters
and
in Kishinev.
And a boy by the name of Nathan. He died, unfortunately. But that's not, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So then after this, my father worked. And his brother, Boris, joined him later on. And he left later on to America, just on the beginning of the First World War, 1914. So I remember him. As a child, my memory is very awake since I was 3 years old. So I can see Uncle Boris coming, and I was crying, and I loved him. I was the only uncle I had. He was pampering me in Aloha, where we lived at that time. And he gave me a little, you know, in which you crush medicine or garlic, you know, a little Stoisov Yiddish, it's called. And he left. Then the war started, the First World War. There was very few Jews in Belgium.
You were born
before the First World War.
What in year? Brussels.
1910.
1910, okay.
Now, you know, everything.
So your early memories of your Uncle Boris were of quite a young child.
1912, 1913. Mm-hmm. And 1914, of course. Mm-hmm. And then Uncle Boris came to America. And I don't know if you are familiar with Strawberry Mansion. He had a studio, Mednik studio, a photographist. He has two sons and a daughter. One was Sal Mednik, and his wife is Miriam Mednik, who was involved with work at City Hall with unwed young mothers, mm-hmm. very prominent. And then I have another cousin by the name of Seymour Mednik, who was also very prominent in his field of industrial photography. And then I have a cousin, Claire Lewin, who is married to an American chap, of course.
Did your father tell you as a young child about the experiences that he had in the army and the pogrom, the Kishinev
yes.
pogrom?
You must excuse me, this is a personal, I cannot help it.
That's okay.
Philadelphia weather.
That's okay.
I hope it doesn't come out like this. As a child, my father had a very awakened life. He started reading the materials of the time, who came out with Karl Marx, Lenin already. It was the beginning of socialism when he was a young man, of course. And he was less than an Orthodox Jew.
Was this difficult to do in his family, or did they permit him
no,
this kind of exposure?
No, there was no question of permission. My paternal grandfather was a very mild person and an understandable person who knew that the world is turning. Mm-hmm. Although they lived in a fairly large size city, Kishinev, they had a very broad mind. A Jewish population in that sense. I remember my father telling me that they would be going to the park and they would eat on kosho, a little dried salami, karnatzler, he would say. Mm-hmm. And in my young mind, I would say, gosh, if I would do that, mother would shoot me because mother was Orthodox. And father would tell me that alone, not to the girls. Not to the girls. I was part of everything that he did. For instance, we would go Saturday to the synagogue in Brussels. No, the Jews were concentrated in different boroughs. We lived in Anderlecht. Anderlecht was near the Southern Station.
How do you spell that?
A-N-D-E-R-L-E-C-H-T. Anderlecht. Mm-hmm. We lived in Anderlecht. And we lived across the park, that just before the war, the First World War. And across the park, on top of the park was a railroad going by. I recall the soldiers going to the front, the enthusiasm throwing a heart attack, you know, that bread from the soldiers. I don't know, you've never seen
mm-hmm.
it.
Mm-hmm.
And the enthusiasm, patriotic songs. And I was a youngster with a Belgian flag. I'll never forget that. And I had been told by my father, hearing what the way he spoke to his brother, and then later on when I was 6 and 7 years old, that often my father, in view to have Sholem Bayis peace in the house, he would say to me, Beryl, don't get mother's nerves. Do what she wants you to do. Don't be like I was. And that's where I learned what he was. He would say, Trefe Kishkoloch. Non-kosher, little sausages.
So he would tell you these tales
yes.
of his rebellion
yes.
as a young person.
But
only for you.
Because, hey, I'm the oldest of the boys.
Mm-hmm.
And then I had to be his accomplice because going to the synagogue shop Saturday morning, we would take little street detour to smoke a cigarette. And he would say, if you tell Ma about it, I'll. So I didn't.
Mm-hmm.
But I couldn't. I mean, I'll come in a second and being involved with the confidence of my father, it was not the easy test because I had to obey my mother's order, and she was very religious, to the point that she was called Atznieh, who was like at Tzaddik, there is Atznieh. So my mother was Atznieh. Mind you that the rabbi would eat in our home, and we were a small Jewish congregation at that time. Very few Polish and Russian Jews. It was more Polish Jews from Warsaw, from Lodz, from Częstochowa, who would come to Belgium, because it was very close to the border, just across Germany, and that's it. Of course, it's large, but it was nevertheless the closest that they could come.
So and this section in Brussels that you're talking about
was a Jewish section.
Was primarily Russian and Polish?
Not primarily Russian. There wasn't such a thing primarily.
Mm-hmm.
If there was 2,000 Jews, there was a lot at that time.
Mm-hmm.
It was before the Polish Jews and the Russian Jews came. It was Hollandish Reformist. The Reformed Jews from Holland were there, and they were assimilated. In the synagogue was the rabbi with a high head. There was an organ playing, and there was a choir. And there was a big apparel that the Jew from Russia and Poland has never known. We know a synagogue was a place of worship where you spoke to God about your problems and your heartaches. And nobody looked at the luxury of the establishment like it was in Belgium. So slowly, they had the few families created a Hasidim Shtibel. There was Hasidim from Poland. And they put together a Hasidim Shtibel where forcefully we had to belong. There was no other one. There was no reform or conservative or Orthodox. And when enough Jews came, after the First World War, there was more Jewish people in Brussels, they made a couple of synagogues. And my father belonged to what they called at that time the Red Synagogue. I'm referring now to 1922 already. The Red Synagogue was, that was the period of the Russian Revolution. And I remember as a youngster, I would listen to my father and his friends discussing, and they would say the ambition was that when the communists come, there would be no more anti-Semitism. All people would be equal, there would be no more war, and everybody will have work, no more hunger. And we would dream, and we would take part, not hunger, that was the dream, not hunger, not to be rationed, because during the First World War we were rationed. We would get the 6 ounces of bread a day, period. That's all. We would go for food every second day to the German canteen. And in the canteen they would give us rations of bread. That would go on for 4 years. And my parents being kosher, because of mother, of course, when we received the pork meat and the fat back and their fat, the pork fat, my mother would exchange with the lady next door. And the Germans would make synthetic products. From coal, they were able to extract saccharin, honey, and margarine. And it tasted very good. They are geniuses.
From coal?
From coal, yes. From coal, they are geniuses. And they would exchange it, and then mother would try to feed us. It was horrible. During the war from America for the children in the school system, we received at that time one little bread a day, like a sandwich roll. And you see, most who suffered was those like my father, who came to Belgium, who had no one in the country. The Jew is a city person.
Mm-hmm.
We don't have acquaintances in the country. He raises a pig, he has a calf, he has crushed wheat and so on. So we always struggled. And my father made surgical instruments. He was a fine craftsman. So the Germans occupying Belgium for 4 years forced him to go to work for them. And he would make instruments. You know, at that time there was horses. See, there was a cavalry. They had horses. So for the surgeons, the veterinarians, he had to make instruments. So he was able to bring once in a while back home a loaf of bread. And the bread was that German bread, very heavy and black. But we couldn't get enough of it, of course. So we grew up with this idea of hunger and a closeness among the Jewish population because we were so few.
The Red Synagogue that you're talking about.
Yeah, all right, I'll come back to it. So in the Red Synagogue was a very brilliant rabbi from Warsaw. He had nothing to do with politics. And the only time the Jews could come together And speak of politics, because during the week everybody was hustling to make a piece of a living. It wasn't easy because Belgium had nothing. Belgium was stealing coal and farmland and dairy. So the Jews, when they came in, they brought with them small industry, packet book making, tailoring, shoemaking, glove making, fur making. And from this, slowly they developed a tremendous industry, and Belgium became one of the big exporters. And the king of Belgium has always been very benevolent for the Jews. Belgium has always been a heaven for the Jews. There was anti-Semitism has always existed. You cannot escape anti-Semitism in the best of heavens. Even in the Vatican, with the Pope of Rome, there is a tremendous anti-Semitism. Then there is always going to be, because they needed an scapegoat. And we want a scapegoat. So the point was that Belgium was good to the Jews. And my father was making out a living. And they would come together on Saturday in the synagogue. And on the way to the synagogue, we would buy the Belgium had Communist Party, Liberal Party, Catholic Party, Socialist. We had about 26 parties. So we would buy a Communist paper and a Socialist paper. And on the way, we would read the paper. And in the synagogue, after you put on the talus and you make your bruches, you speak politics. So slowly you take out the paper, you show this article. And the rabbi would bang on his bench and he would be infuriated. And that's the atmosphere in which I grew up of freedom and democracy. Mm.
Was the Red Synagogue then a nickname for this?
A nickname, of course. The Reuter Yidl, they called them the Little Red Jews. Mm-hmm. And then they know this one is a communist, this one is a socialist, this one is a politician, this one is a whatever party there was. Mm-hmm. And in the house, when you came together, there was no radio and television, and there was no electricity, we still had gas. So when people came together, what was the joy? Conversation. There was a talent in speaking. Mm-hmm. There were practically good orators.
Did your father tell you stories? We had mentioned the Kishinev pogroms, and you were going to tell me more about his experience with that. Did he tell you any stories about experiences with the rebellions at that time, uprisings?
Well, the thing is that he told me, and that I recall, although I didn't pay too much attention, when you are young, you listen, and then you think of children things. But as I grew older, it came back into my mind that he told me that very few non-Jewish people were helpful to the Jewish population, because the Jew always was able to hack out a living, and poverty was mostly amongst the mujiks. It was Russia under the Tsar. So there was a big jealousy. And jealousy was always prevalent because a Jew for Sabbath, he had to have a goy. So there was a Shabbos goy.
Right.
So he was already employed by a Jew. And that's where it came into antagonism. They didn't see that the Jew didn't use him. He just asked him for help. Mm-hmm. But in the perverted and distorted mind of the mujik, they couldn't understand that. Mm-hmm. So my father then, I would say one thing, that when he left Russia, my father was trying to not too much to dwell upon it. He was looking forward. Although I had my grandparents there, and uncles and aunts who died, of course.
In Russia, of course. In the pogroms?
In the pogrom. Okay, let me tell you. My father, when my father left on the pogrom, after him left, a sister came to America. Beile, Zisl, and Heike. Three sisters came to America of him, plus his brother Boris. Four of the children came here. Now, I think that was all of the children. And then the grandparents remained. Mm. Then I remember my brother Zulu, Samuel, was born. And I remember that we received the sad news, not to Belgium, but from my uncle in America, because my uncle received the news of the death of his father. And 30 days later, after Schleuschen, after the period of Shiva sitting, he wrote to my father, because my father, having a large family, he figured if he tells them later, they wouldn't have to waste a week. But my mother, in her fanatism, said, no, your father deserves sitting Shiva. So I remember in the house was like Tisha B'Av. Mm-hmm. Sad, everybody sitting on benches. We were young children, you know. So when my little brother was born, a name was given for him. Mm-hmm. And that's where I remember my Zedezur. We had no family in Belgium. Just my father, mother, brothers, and sister.
Mm-hmm. Your grandfather then died
in Kishinev.
In Kishinev, in a pogrom? Or,
no, no.
Or this was a natural
natural cause? Death, of course, caused by the revolution and everything else, you know, that you cannot avoid.
Mm-hmm.
Remember, those survivors of the wars amongst the Jewish people had very strong constitutions. Weak people didn't make it. How I survived is a miracle, but I made it.
Mm-hmm.
I'm here to tell of that miracle.
Mm-hmm.
May she rest in peace, my first wife. She survived, but she died young.
Mm-hmm.
Because I don't know how her organism absorbed whatever element was to give her a disease that was not traceable and not healable in America.
Mm-hmm.
So she's a victim of the war and a victim who died young.
Mm-hmm.
I had a strong constitution, I could eat anything, you name it, I ate it. If it crawled, I killed it, and if it was dead, I swallowed it.
Mm-hmm.
Survival was the key word. It was not pleasant. I have told stories, but no horror stories, I don't want to dwell. I was in problems about 3 years ago, I had a recurrence of nightmares, went to see a psychiatrist, and I stopped after 2 sessions. I realized if I cannot help myself, a psychiatrist cannot help me, because they didn't go through it. I always give an example. We know all what it means to give birth. We know everything about squeezing the hand and what can I do for you, darling. But actual giving birth, nobody knows but the mother gives birth. So it's with experiences. I can speak to you from today to tomorrow. You will understand. You will put your mind to it. What do you know of hunger? In America, you cannot be hungry. I could live all my life with it. If I would be a bum, I wouldn't have to work. There is so much food.
Mm-hmm. Tell me, go back to the war years, the First World War. You said you were
in
very
the first,
hungry.
Yeah, very hungry. So when the Germans came into Belgium, they started rationing food. I was in in public school, first grader. And to go to school was like about couple miles from the house, a couple kilometers. That's about a mile and a half. And we would have to be in school 8 o'clock. In the class was 4 more Jewish boys. That's all there was. I think that the whole extent of Jewish children in the school was about maybe 2 dozen. It was public school. And at that time, when you went to kindergarten, you went with that teacher until 8th grade. The teacher went with you until 8th grade, and then you went to a professional school to learn a trade,
mm-hmm.
or you went to Ateneum, or you went to higher studies.
Did you experience any kind of anti-Semitism in your school?
Yes, but this was not anti-Semitism. It was a natural reflection upon the church's teachings.
Mm-hmm.
I killed Jesus Christ.
Mm-hmm.
I killed fine, but that he told him my father killed, that I couldn't take.
Mm-hmm.
So that's where the fight started.
And you would actually have fights.
Oh, yeah, physical
fights.
But I, like, again, I was very robust. And I loved the scrap. Let's teach the Goyim. My friends were Polish Jews. None of them was Russian. And they were meek, coming from a family who said, here's the second cheek, here's the third cheek. Pull the beard, pull the pears. I was no more that.
Mm.
I had heard from my father fight. And because I heard from my father fight when I was a kid, that was my right.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't kill Jesus Christ, and I did not change blood into matzes, and there was a lie in the Bayless process, and Dreyfus was a maker for anti-Semitism. I wasn't guilty of nothing. And also a child, a youngster, I knew that.
Did you ever have a non-Jewish boy who was a friend?
Oh, yes. Plenty of them.
Okay.
Yes, plenty of them. But not to fight with me against the other.
Mm. They would never defend
you. And if
you
to have friends, you have to use your head.
Mm-hmm.
Friends don't come naturally at that time. You had to coerce them by giving them a stamp, a couple of marbles. You bought their friendship. But anyway, to have a friend was good to have it. You are not alone.
You mean because of your Judaism, you felt you had to?
Right, right.
To
ignorance. See, the parents didn't know better. The school system was very liberal. We had religious classes in school. Every day, no, 3 times a week. From 11:30 to 12 was religious classes.
What kind of religious classes?
The Jews went to the class where they teach Judaism.
Mm-hmm.
And this was by the Reformed synagogue from the center of the city. They had school teachers in French, everything. And the Catholics would go to the church just around the corner,
mm-hmm.
for 3 times a week, learn religion.
Mm-hmm.
that's important. Mm-hmm. But there was no discrimination in that respect. Nobody would make you feel. It's amongst kids, children. That's where anti-Semitism was there.
Did you feel welcome in these friends' homes, the ones that you did have?
Oh, we didn't go to homes. Don't go to a Goyish home. What's the matter? But you strafe everything.
I see.
The only home I went in was the next door. We lived in little homes in old Brussels near the canals. And there was a family, Swart was the name, and they had one son, Richard. And that family, Swart, was Belgians from hundreds of years, husband and wife and a boy. And during the war, they would both work in a factory doing things for the Germans, of course, that's all it went. But they had plenty of food. And we had a dividing wall in our yard. And Richard, their son, would call me, Bernard, come over, something good to eat. And in the kitchen was a table like that, loaded with heavy, sweet milk. What do you call that? You know, that condensed milk.
Mm-hmm.
And they had brown sugar. They had real butter. They had honey. And he would enjoy me making a concoction. I would make a container full of everything, as he could a spoon and swallow. I was hungry. During the war, in view to deceive the Germans, it was an imperialistic war. It was no anti-Semitism. And in my father's home was three German soldiers billeted, Jews.
Mm.
And they would bring for the children cacao, synthetic cacao.
Cocoa.
And we would drink it out of jars from jam because we had glasses at the time. So one day I remember they came and they said to my father, remove all the copper in the house and if you have wool mattresses, take them away and bury them because they're collecting copper and wool.
Copper and wool.
Because the Germans then, the Kaiser Wilhelm was running short.
Mm.
So I remember wherever we had beds with copper bowls and bars, my father unscrewed everything. And we moved the stove away from the chimney, and we shoved everything into the chimney, all the copper. And we took the mattresses, we had three wool mattresses, and we made, in the yard, we unheard it, and buried the mattresses and put soil on top, not to give to the Germans.
Mm.
And I remember those people were there, then after the war was finished, then all the Belgians took out their mattresses on the street, it was wormy and everything else, and they took out the copper. It was experiences. Then I remember then going to school, the teachers would teach us patriotic songs, and like Flotte de Petit Drapeau, and what can I do on a 6 year old? I go with the Belgian flag. So you take the flag and break, you cannot shoot me. So they gave us an illegal paper called La Nation Belge, the Belgian people. And we took that paper and we would go and slip it with a pin, attach it to anybody we could attach it. And there was propaganda from the underground. There was patriots who were hidden in the First World War, mind you, all against the Germans. So then we had ice picks and they had at that time rubber tires from solid rubber. And we had to put the pick in.
Wait, were you involved in this?
Sure, all kids, and groups of 10, 12. Why? Because we would like to open the doors and steal their breads or steal whatever there was to be stolen.
Did you, lived how in the street. Were you organized?
There was no organization, we were a bunch of kids on the street. And then one Sagitz would say, how about if we go and bother the Bosch? Bosch is derogatory for German. And everything to do for the Bosch is a pleasure. You know, we hate the enemy. We hated their step, their goose step, and their guttural, and always the fear and the bombing. They were guilty for the war. We didn't want a war. So they said, okay, let's go. Bernard, I was already, I was always a Gesinterbulls, they called me. I was a bouncer, they called me. And you, Bernard, you take whatever you can. So when they opened, I could carry 8 loaves of bread, 25 kilo bread. 25 kilo was a third of my weight. And I would run, I remember, like a guy with a triple strangled hernia, I would run with the bread just to hide away.
Oh.
And what can they do? They shot. But sometimes they would catch somebody. But we were very nasty to the Germans. And our parents were so afraid of us to get armed.
But, and yet you had three Germans billeted in your house.
Jews.
But they were Jews. So it was
the
different.
The Jews,
yeah.
Their fault. You remember, in Belgium, when you are born a boy, he knows the day he goes into the service military. He goes into the military. He knows exactly the day. It's not like in America.
Mm.
At that time was defensive war, if you lived in Belgium or in France. It's not offensive words.
What about your father?
No, my father was never, because he was too old of a man. He had too many children.
Okay.
You see, after so many children, they didn't touch you. How did I become a Belgian? You have no privilege of becoming a Belgian in Belgium by being born in the land. That doesn't count.
That doesn't count.
There is one America in the world, that's the United States of America.
Mm.
This America is a heaven for all of those who have no nationality or a bad one. What is a bad nationality? Polish, Russian, Romanian, Hungarian, Bulgarian, that's bad. American is good. What is good nationalities? Swiss, Belgium, French, Luxembourg, Liechtenstein, Monaco, those are the best nationalities.
So how did you become Belgian?
Because I was the oldest of the boys, and I was from a large family. And there was a law saying that my father was a Nansen pass. You know what a Nansen? Because there was a tremendous disturbance amongst the population, there was a flow of aliens all over the world, the United Nations at the time in Geneva decided, being that there is such a wild movement of nations all over the world, they're going to make that...
This is tape one, side two, of an interview with Mr. Bernard Mednicki on April 27th, 1982, with Josie Fisher. The name of the pass, the passport.
The passport was a Nansen passport. And with that passport, the countries where you wanted to go, or they allowed you to come in, they couldn't throw you out again. Or they didn't allow you to come in, and that's it, period. You couldn't come in. Having his brother in America, my father had cultivated the idea of coming to the States, but America didn't accept him because he had an Nansen pass. And being that I was a child from a person who had no country, that was called apatride, I put in a request to become a Belgian national. At that time, Belgium...
How old were you? At
that 18.
18. He was not... Let me clarify this. He could not come to America because he had this passport?
That's right. No Nansen passport could come to America.
Why?
Because then America didn't want an influx of aliens.
And he was not under a certain flag then by having
Nobody.
This passport?
He was without a country.
I see.
That's called apatride, without a country.
I see.
And I was an apatride, and all the children and mother. When I found out that I could become a Belgian, I started moving. At that time, my parents, thank God, they left them alone. And whatever I did to become a Belgian, I had to do it by myself.
What was involved?
Or was involved to run to the ministers, to the administrations. And
you mean the government ministers?
The government, of course. Yeah. And it was involved of getting all kind of papers from City Hall, because in Belgium you do not move. Although we are a beautiful democracy, there is more discipline than an American democracy. We feel that democracy demands order. And without order, democracy is a farce. In America, we are 220 million people. I have never had an automobile in my life. I've never driven. I never had a license, a driver's license. What is my identification? I carry my American passport with me. It's cumbersome. It's not obligatory. If I want to tell you my name is Smith, you have no proof of telling me that I'm not. Now, in Belgium, we all have an identity card. They try to do it in America, but America with civil liberties and everything else, and it's so involved. See, America is a big Goliath. And when I step on your toe until it comes to the brain, it takes 12,000 years. Mm-hmm. Belgium is a small nation. What is decided in the morning at night, it goes through.
You were 18, you say, when
yes.
you applied for this pass.
No, I applied when I was 16.
Had you been... You had finished your public schooling
yes,
already. Had
yes.
you gone on to
no,
any other kind of
no,
specialized?
No, it was not possible because my father decided I will be a craftsman. At that time, parents had decisions to make for children. And I was 9 years old when I started to learn my trade, going to school, working with father, and I'll become an apprentice.
You were apprentice to?
An orthopedic technician.
I see.
I was a brace maker. And I was a glove maker.
In gloves?
Belgium, gloves, yes.
And
ladies,
braces.
Gloves and braces. One goes with the other. Belgium not having a lot of the laws of protection for the crafts, for the working people. We had a lot of people losing fingers in shops and in factories. It was sweatshops. Our capitalism is like all over the world.
So when you're talking about gloves, you're talking about...
Regular gloves and for people who needed prostheses.
I see.
Cosmetic.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So from one you go to the other, you made a very elegant glove too. But mostly I was an orthopedic
mm-hmm,
technician.
Mm-hmm.
And I learned my trade.
You were living at home?
Oh,
with
yes.
Your, with your
there
family.
Was no other way.
There was no other way.
You didn't
of
even
course.
Know who would dare to leave the house.
And during these years, in addition to your public schooling, you had gone through the traditional...
Oh, Cheder
and
Hebrew, of course,
yes.
and Melamed and everything
mm-hmm.
else.
Mm-hmm.
Then in evenings I would take I would learn in the evening what I had missed. Like, for instance, I had missed in history, I had missed in literature. So I would go in evening classes
mm-hmm.
and try to catch up. There was no points in it, but it was self satisfaction, and it didn't cost any money.
Mm-hmm.
And the time was very short because my day started 5 o'clock in the morning until 11.
Mm-hmm.
It was long days. In those days, you had in the morning you had to have your prayers. Then you had to help father work before you go to school. Then you had to run to school. Then you had to come back from school. Then you have to pray again. And that's time consuming. You had never time to play. Who played outside?
Was there any talk of Zionism in your
family? There was. I belonged to the Istadrut HaShomer HaTzair when I was 13 years old.
Mm-hmm.
And my Haverim were part on the second Aliyah, or the third Aliyah, but I couldn't make it. I could not decide to tell my father, you worked for your children, I'll work for my children.
Mm-hmm.
I couldn't do that.
Mm-hmm.
I said, Pa, that's the way it is. When I started making money, I brought the money in. Then my mother died when she was young. And my father became completely then lost. He had lost a companion of many years who were his children. And so at that time, I would bring in the wages in the house, and the house would live thanks to my income.
Mm-hmm. And what about during the 20s in Belgium? What atmosphere
The 20s was the atmosphere. We always were neighbors with Germany. It was von Hindenburg, the Treaty of Versailles,
mm-hmm.
political trouble, the USSR, and Poland anti-Semitism. And once in a while, my father would get letters from America from his brother. And his brother would say, try to do something to come to America. And my mother was not to travel. She said, Americano Glicken. The Americano Glicken, what? Struggle in America? We're already here. We heard of anti-Semitism in America, and then gangsters, and everything else. So my mother didn't really think of America. And America to me was so remote, like from you remote is now Uganda.
Mm-hmm.
I had no dreams, ambitions, or desire of America. The only thing we liked from America is that pictures where everybody was happy, scrapped the houses, everybody was always making a good living. But when we start reading, and we read Upton Sinclair, and we start reading the tragedies of life, then we saw that America was really not such a heaven. It was really a heaven for those who were bloody, like the Vanderbilt and the Rockefellers, who could step on hearts and brains and toes.
Were you reading in English at that time, or were these books
French,
translated into
French?
French?
My English was American. I don't speak now better than after 3 years in America.
You were speaking Yiddish at home?
Yiddish, French, Flemish, and German.
Mm-hmm.
That's the languages we spoke in the
mm-hmm.
house. Now, for mother and dad, they bought the Flemish paper, because Flemish is similar to Yiddish. So I learned to transliterate because of mother. She lost her sight. At that time, we did not know much about all modern diseases like diabetes, and God knows what else she had. So when she became blind, I would get the paper, sit on her knee, sit on a little bench near her, and read the paper in Yiddish.
Mm-hmm.
So she would say, "Is a Yiddish Zeitung Barrel?" And I would say, "Yeah, ma." And then one of the children would say, "Ma, the Zelta Ligen." "No, ma, I don't tell the truth, it's a French paper."
Mm-hmm.
The mother would say, "Why don't you tell me it's a French paper?" And she would compliment me. And I've gained that knack, and today I can do the same thing, translate automatically 3-4 languages.
Mm-hmm.
We choose all kind of a talent.
A valuable one.
No. I admire you girls. Anyway.
1928, you were trying to get your...
1928,
your
so after...
Belgian papers.
Yes, after I had made all my necessary requests and so on, and I brought proof that I was an honest man, because in view to get anything, you, like I said, you have an identity card. And the identity card is a little... I have one, the old one. It's a little booklet in which there is your picture. And in there is written the names of your father and of your mother, where you were born, the street in which you live, what is your occupation, when it was given to you, and then there is a number that says in what book in City Hall you are registered. And you carry in your packet, and every policeman is the right to ask you, "Can I see your papers?" "I'll be sure, that's all." No big deal, it's not a hassle.
Mm-hmm.
It just wants to know your identity, it's entitled to work. And we don't see anything wrong with it. In America, harassment. We have to, but we are a young nation here. We need another 500 years.
Did this mean that you are a Belgian citizen to
yeah.
have these papers?
No. If I'm a Belgian, I have a green card. If you are an alien authorized to live legally in Belgium, you have a green with a white stripe.
So what did you get a green card
of course,
then?
Of
you
course,
did.
I received
mm-hmm.
a green card. No, I had a green with a white stripe
mm-hmm.
until I became a Belgian. Then I received a green one.
Mm-hmm.
Well, among the Jewish population, there was something.
Mm.
Mednitsky is seen as a Belgian. Bernard Mednitsky is a Belgian. Now, that means everything is open for me. I can work in a bank. I can become a string cleaner. I can drive a trolley car. I can become a policeman. I can open my own store.
You could vote?
I can vote. Well, vote was the last thing that we thought of because we never had that privilege. We never had that privilege. But then when I started getting that privilege, I became very much involved in political life.
Mm.
Because it's in you.
Mm-hmm.
Every Jew is an activist, just for survival.
Mm-hmm.
If we wouldn't, we wouldn't be here. I don't have to tell you, you know that. And I yet joined, of course, the union, a syndicat. It was a guild from craftsmen belonging mm-hmm. to the same profession.
This was a Jewish guild?
No.
This was
no.
not?
We are not that big. We cannot organize.
Mm-hmm.
For Passover, we had to bring in the stuff from Antwerp. There was a nice Jewish congregation. But we had, I think, one Jewish grocery store in the whole neighborhood. That's mm-hmm. all. We were on the strength. And so I received authorization. And at that time, Belgium is very prolific. A family of 23 children is not abnormal. There was a royal society of large families. You must have a minimum of 6 children. We were 8, so we belonged. So we had privileges. We didn't have to wait in line for a trolley car. When the trolley car came, I showed you my card, you moved and let me go on top of it. If I went to a store, I would get a reduction in prices. Mm. On the train, I would pay half a price. And things like that, all kind of privileges.
And this was automatically for any family
that's
that
law.
Had more
that's
than
the
six
law.
Children.
More than 6 children belonged to the Royal Society of Large Families. And because of that...
In order to belong to the Royal Society of Large Families, you did not have to be a citizen.
Right.
Okay.
And my father had belonged because the privileges were there.
Mm-hmm.
You had to get clothes for children reductions. And Belgium always gave a children's subsidy. For instance, if you were a working man and you had a child, you would get so much a month for the child. That's called children's money.
Mm-hmm.
And if you had 6 children, you would get enough because they were logical in the sense that if you and I, we both work on the same job, you're a bachelor. You make $100 a week and I make $100 a week when I have 4 kids. Now you will live much better than I will, but I have done much more than you have done for the country.
Mm-hmm.
So therefore, you and I, we all paid a very small fraction of our wages plus the employer in a fund who would send children's money to the mother, not to the father. With that money, she buys shoes, the necessary food, and clothes for the children. And that was controlled by social workers. They would come and see if the children are well-dressed. See, we lived a very feudal way. The police would go on the street, and every policeman would know everybody in the houses. He would knock on your door, good morning, how come you didn't wash your pavement today?
Mm.
Extremely clean.
Mm-hmm.
No guns at that time, they had canes, the policemen. It was, of course, a more civilized world after the First World War.
Mm.
And then after they told me I can become a Belgian, I have the papers, it's called opté. I had an option.
Mm-hmm.
And I optioned towards Belgium citizenship.
Mm-hmm.
As I became a Belgium citizen, I knew automatically I have to make my 9 months of military service. So the military service in Belgium was that you went into the morning 8 o'clock with your uniform into the caserne. You did all kind of drillings. And at night they gave you money for the trolley car, for a couple of glasses of beer, and a pack of cigarettes, and you went home. That was day serving. So they trained like in Switzerland, you know, a National Guard. And when I went in for training, after 4 weeks, there was too many soldiers. And being that I was from a large family, they let me go.
Mm.
That means that sender, and everybody was so proud to be a Belgian soldier, the little head with a pompon up front, you know. And my brothers and sisters, my brother is a soldier. And it was like, you know, it was something. Anyway, my father's name, Metnitsky's son, Belgium. After me, all the children became Belgian.
Mm.
Because I had put in that all my brothers and sisters who were born in Belgium should become Belgian automatically, at least have a nationality. But my 2 sisters, Rosa and Sheva, they couldn't because they were born in Russia.
You could get citizenship?
I worked that my brothers and sisters should get the papers.
I see.
Nationality.
I
but
see.
My 2 sisters, they could. So my father was without a land, without a country, and we were Belgian citizens.
There was no way that someone who was born in another country could have gotten Belgian citizenship?
Buy citizenship, yes. You can buy...
You could buy it.
You can buy naturalization. If you have a lot of money, you buy small naturalization. That means you can vote locally for the local elections. And if you have much more money, you have done things for the country, like many Jews have done, they give you the big naturalization. You can vote for Congress and Senate.
But in order to become a citizen, if you were born in Belgium, was not as complicated if you were born there.
Well, also you had to be able to prove that you were an asset to the country. Had I been a no-goodnik, they would not have allowed me to become a citizen. Had my father been disreputable, they would not have allowed me either, you know.
You had to pay for it, though.
No, I did not.
You did not have to.
I didn't.
Okay, your sisters would have had to pay.
If they would have so chosen to become, yes.
I see, okay.
But it was of no importance. It was important for us, the young people, born there. You see, and my sister being already elder, you know. My then mother died when I was 18 years old, 17 years old. And life has changed then.
In what way?
Well, in every way. Father lost completely desire to live. We were a large family. Only one sister was married. And being that he lost all ambition, I had still Rebecca, Maurice, Charles, and Zulu would still go to school. And I was working. So I brought my pay on. And I worked very hard. I dropped my apprenticeship. I was an apprentice from 9 to 21. I had 11 years apprenticeship to become a craftsman.
From 9 until 21?
Yes, because it was a very rigorous training then. See, being a prosthesis technician was not an easy trade. See, that's paramedical, and they had to learn. Then I had to go to evening classes and learn anatomy and learn whatever is pertained to it. And I was working with masters who were very rigorous. After this, I worked, but I couldn't make enough money, so I quit the job, and I started unloading barges on the canal. Who paid good money.
So this was in
Brussels.
What year?
1928, 1929. I would unload barges of sand, coal, for good money. So you carry 50 kilo on your back, going up the ladder from the hold, and then you go empty down. All day, like ants climbing up and down the ladder. Men, chain of men doing it to unload the ship. Today they have compact machinery, empty a ship in no time. Then was a job. After this, that job finished, and I went to construction. And I was a mason's helper, carried the bricks on the third floor on the shoulders. And there I almost broke the neck many times. After this, I looked for a job. I needed money, so I went to a steel mill. And I was working with a sledgehammer 7 hours a day, breaking up the old foundry pieces. But like I said again to you, I was physically strong like a bull. And I worked with rage, and that rage helped me to survive. I was a big eater. Then there was food.
You when you say I mean? You worked with rage, what do you mean?
Rage that, why is life made at my mother? We had a good God. We were raised in Judaism. God is my father, and here he takes my mother away, a mother from 8 children. And mother always, in her fanaticism, would say, this world is a valley of tears. The real world, the world of life, is Olam Habo. And we couldn't understand that mother wanted to go, all right, we all love God, but stay with us. So when he took her away, she died before Hanukkah, bitter winter. When she died, something happened to me, and in my heart I hated God, and I didn't like it anymore, because we did not learn Judaism as a philosophy. We learned Judaism as the fact of life. That is it. Later on, of course, we understand better. We hope, in fact, who understands anything? Absurdity. All life is absurdity. So anyway, to come back to the story, I worked there for a long while, but my sister was, I was very unhappy, I had broken my training. In the meantime, Sheva, became engaged. That's my second older sister. Rosa was the oldest and Sheva was the second one. Sheva became engaged and she married. In fact, I found her children later. They are now in America with us here. And she moved out from the house. So Rosa was responsible. And Rosa was like, in fact, when I was born, Rosa was my godmother. Mm. There was no Jews enough to have somebody being godmother. So she was my godmother. And, you know, in families of large of children, there is affinities. There is clans. I love you better than I love her. Oh, not that I don't like her. She's my sister. But I will side with you in case of something. So Rosa and I were one piece of flesh. We were one. I looked up to her, and she was a short one, and I was not a good boy. So she would say to me, bend on, I should hit you. I would come down, she'd laugh less. Mm. I'd say, you feel better, Rosa. She was like a mother. Mm. Unfortunately, the Nazis destroyed her, killed her. So, in the meantime, I start getting, I worked until 9, 10 o'clock at night at my bus, and I went back to my trade. And that bus had a big contract for the coal mines to make special gloves. And there was those little things in between the fingers called in French fourchette. And those little things is a very tedious job. You have to cut them and match it to the color of the skin. So I could get this to take home to work at night. So I would take bundles of scrap leather and I would stay on my bench and pull the leather, it's soft leather. And I would work on it until 11, 12, 1 o'clock in the morning. Because every time I made an extra franc, it was more money to make it easier in the house. We were not hungry, but we didn't have the facility of having a franc in your pocket for spending.
This was spending. When? In the early
30s? Not early 30s. 1930. No, in 30, in fact, I met my first wife. Mm-hmm. And things were getting better. Then my sister Rosa found a young man, and she married. Then in due time, a young woman came to the house and she fell in love with my father. Well, for us children, a young woman fell in love with father. It's like a 6-year-old would say to you, I want to marry you. But nobody would tell father that. And she was the daughter of a rabbi from Poland. Father took a trip. Went to Poland to meet her parents. And he came back and he said, children, I'm going to marry you. I was 13 years a widower, or 12 years. No, not that long. He was a widower for many long years. And then he said to me, we're going to get married. So all the children look, it's father's desire. In the meantime, before he was getting married, I had met a young woman in the synagogue in Yom Kippur. Looking over to the girl's side, because the synagogue was a hole rented with a blanket in the middle, and that's it. That young woman was in Belgium illegally. There was a many illegal Jews in Belgium. The law says like this in Belgium, if you come to work in the coal mines, you can work 2 years and get papers to become legal in Belgium. The Jews, they all came to work in the coal mine. Within 2 weeks, they had heart diseases, lung diseases. They all found diseases. They never worked in the coal mine. Only Jews. Mm. Weak, there was weak bodies. There was nothing. It's not the Jew of America. Mm. Do you know you are a golden product? You are a tall girl, Kenner. Where do you see girls like that? You're a giant for the Belgians, the French. Mm. I'm the tall man in Belgium. Small people. During the pogroms and the wars and everything else, we have been cleaned out. So I met a beautiful young woman in the synagogue, and she was here illegally. And she was working in a lingerie. And I was friend with the boy of that Mr. and Mrs. Klingsberg. And that lady, she was exploiting her. She was extremely beautiful, 18 years old, or 19. And she had 2 sisters in Belgium who worked in factories. There was no other way. Depression was there. And I met that young lady. And at that time, she had brought a Jew from Cuba to sell her away. Not to sell her, to marry her and get a nice piece of gold because she brought a pretty girl to an old man. Mm. So when this young woman saw me getting very pleasantly influenced by her, and I asked her to go out. She said to me the first thing, I'm not legal. Oh yeah, I figured that's good. Now, if she's not legal, I can marry her, make her legal. Yeah, men scheme right away. When you love somebody, you scheme.
Yeah.
And so my father said, well, when are you going to get married? You're not even 21. I said, Pa, I said, I'll wait. And I waited. And I waited until I was 21 and a half. And then, first time in my life, my sister said, Bernard, she said, you must tell Pa that you want to get married now. If not, Pa is going to pull you until he wants you to get married. So it was, I married, and I split my pay with my father so that he should not suffer too much financially. In the meantime, I was going with that young woman, and I rented one room furnished. Started very modest, a bed and a table, a little stove, and my bench.
Mm-hmm.
That bench followed me. I have my scissors here, my tools, everything.
You still have the
oh,
tools?
Oh, yes. That no Jew moves without. And you know this, I bless my father's memory. My father said, a Jew must have a trade. Wherever he goes, he should make a living. Now, assuming, God forbid, that you have to run away and make a living in Okinawa, what do you do? Social work. What can you do? You know the weaver? You know the packer bootmaker? You know the shoemaker or a baker or a tailor?
Mm-hmm.
And my father had a good idea.
Mm-hmm.
And he
That's
made a craftsman out of me. And I was always thankful to him. And I was always respectful. And I split my pay with him. But I worked home very much. After work, I would bring homework. And Shabbos, you don't work. But Sunday, I would work Saturday night. And Sunday, I get no free time. It didn't bother me. I was in love. So the first year, we had a baby. After 1 year married, we had a baby. And my father got married. And that made a complete change. He started making a living. He went back into what he did.
Yeah.
And then he had a little boy, my little brother. Mm. My father was then 50-some-odd years old.
Mm.
But of all the children we were, he was the most gorgeous one. He had teeth like pearls and eyes like jade, black, fantastic. And he was just unbelievable, and everybody loved him. My little brother Jacob, he was killed by the Nazis, of course. And then I moved out from that one room. I had a good job, and I was a hard worker. And I rented an apartment. In Belgium, you don't buy homes that easy. You can live all your life in a nice apartment. A house in Belgium goes from generation to generation to generation. And I was involved politically with the Socialist Party, like the Democrats in America. I was an activist. When Hitler came to power in the beginning, in 1933, I started getting active against Hitler's political activities. We had in Belgium our own Hitler, Léon de Grelle. Léon de Grelle was the Belgium go-lighter. He was our Zeisenkart, a traitor. And we bodily fought him.
He was running for office as well?
No, he was not running for office. He wanted to become the go-lighter like Hitler in
mm-hmm.
Germany.
Mm-hmm.
Don't forget, we were poisoned every day by the news in French and mm-hmm. in Flemish.
There was a Nazi party then also.
Of course, it was a
mm-hmm.
National Socialist Party.
Yes.
National Socialist
mm-hmm.
Party. And Parti d'Unité Nationale, they called themselves. National Unity Party of Belgium.
Mm-hmm.
Against the foreigners, against the Jews, against the blacks, against the Freemasons and the Judaic Kabbalah. And that's what it was called, like Kabbalah Judaique. So we start fighting bodily against them. I remember coming home with a split face because we thought we had belts with big and buckles. And
you had belts?
Oh, yeah, we had a group from workers from our union.
Uh-huh.
And we would go fight meetings when they had.
You would fight at political meetings?
Oh, yes,
you'd try to break up political meetings?
Sure, because you see, the people is, we always have found in the population a certain amount of people who are open to all kind of subversive permissiveness, hooliganism. If today I would tell my neighbor that he is a free hand to kill and rob, it would be his joy because he has no moral fiber, he is an alcoholic, Yes. And you have many like that all over the world. America is no special privilege in that. So we do the same thing in Belgium. So we were trying, if we cannot get him, they won't get poisoned by his propaganda. The police, of course, was trying to remain neutral.
So they did not arrest you or?
Oh, they were disturbing us. They were chasing us, the gendarmerie, with their horses and their long sword. They would, you know, we were the attacker.
Mm-hmm.
And being the attacker, we were wrong. It's like when somebody hits you in the rear, and you are even guilty because you stopped brusquely. And see, he was guilty in the back. And so, my son Armand was born. And he grew up in an atmosphere where we had refugees already from Austria in the house. Because we had to give hospitality to those who were running away.
Your son was born in what year?
33.
Mm-hmm.
33, yes. There's a 33, let's see, what is it? Yeah, that's right. My son is 49, Kenneth Owen.
Mm-hmm.
Older than you, see me there? Much older.